Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be back speaking to the club. It struck me as I came up on the train today that in arranging a contest between Ramsay and Strawson, which is really what this paper's about, I might be thought to have been trying to create, a philosophical logic version of the Varsity Match. And that the there might also be some doubts about the impartiality of the scorer. In this effort, I feel a bit like going into the lion's den here, but never mind. Some people may doubt if there's anything left for a philosopher to say about truth. We have a practical grasp of the difference between true and false from childhood, and Aristotle gave a nice theoretical account of the notions nearly 2,500 years ago. Just a quote you know by heart, but I'll say it anyway. To say what is that it's not, he wrote, or of what's not that it is false. While to say of what is that it is, and of what's not that it's not, is true. There are, though, different ways of developing Aristotle's idea. In this paper, I want to elaborate a natural but curiously neglected version of it, and show how the result illuminates both the paradox of the liar and the so-called axiomatic approaches to truth that many logicians now favour. My preferred elaboration certainly isn't novel, but I've not seen it developed in quite the way I'm going to recommend. And as usual in philosophical logic, the precise articulation turns out to matter. So, first section, Ramsay's account of truth. By the way, does everybody have sight of a handout? Good. To say what is that it is true, or as one might more naturally put it in English, it's to speak truly. In speaking truly, or indeed falsely, a speaker will have produced a declarative utterance, which I'm going to understand to include written or printed inscriptions, as well as instances of speech. Some people deem it infelicitous to predicate truth or falsehood of such utterances, as opposed to the propositions or thoughts they express. One may, though, say that in producing a declarative utterance, its speaker spoke truly or spoke falsely, and this is precisely what I'm going to mean by calling such an utterance true or false. Is there a way of parlaying Aristotle's dictum into definitions of truth and falsity for declarative utterances, or at least into necessary and sufficient conditions for such an utterance to be true or false? The dictum certainly yields a gloss on the notions of speaking truly and speaking falsely when we're given what the speaker says. For someone to say truly that snow is white, for example, is for him to say that snow is white in circumstances where snow is white. As many writers have remarked, though, that thought, while right as far as it goes, does not provide a general elucidation of truth, even as the notion applies to declarative utterances. For we often apply truth to utterances where it's not given what they say. What we would like are statements of the form, utterance U is true if and only if, and then some condition on U, and similarly for falsehood, which apply generally, not merely when we're given the content of U. Some may be tempted to say U is true if and only if it expresses a true proposition, but that proposal just pushes the problem back. For now we have to say what it is for a proposition to be true, and indeed what propositions themselves are. Well, I'm not going to canvass the various proposals that philosophers have made in their quest for general elucidations of this kind. Rather, I want to focus on the suggestion which seems to be the most promising. In On Truth, a book he drafted in 1927-29, and which appeared some 60 years after his death, Ramsay took the primary bearers of truth to be beliefs or judgments, terms he used synonymously to apply to particular mental states which have both propositional content and, I quote, some degree of the affirmative character that's present in judging that such and such is the case, but is absent from merely wondering whether it's the case. Ramsay then proposed a definition of truth as it applies to beliefs in this sense, and this is on the handout. Any belief, whatever, he says, we may symbolise as a belief that P, where P is a variable sentence, just as A and B are variable words or phrases, or terms, as they're called in logic. We can then say that a belief is true if it's a belief that P and P, in Mr. Russell's symbolism, and you get a symbolic version of just that. Similarly, and in a slightly updated symbolism, B is false if and only if there exists a P such that B is a belief that P and not P. Parallel accounts may be given for other sorts of truth-bearer. I've been calling a declarative utterance true when, in producing it, its speaker speaks truly. In the same spirit, let such an utterance say that P when in producing it, its speaker thereby expresses the proposition that P. So sayings don't have to have the force of assertions. Given this notion of saying, we can adapt Ramsay's account to provide the elucidations of truth and falsity for individual utterances in the form sought, and these are TR and FR on the handout, which just applies to utterances what Ramsay says about beliefs. I should just remark that the account of truth and falsity he gives in On Truth is very different from the better-known accounts of the redundancy theory he gave a couple of years earlier in Facts and Propositions. I've written a lot about the differences before. I'll take them as read today. Versions of Ramsay's theory remain popular. Tim Williamson takes a central applications of truth and falsity to type sentences as potentially uttered in particular contexts. He uses true SC to mean the type sentence S is true as uttered with its present meaning in the context C, and say CSP to mean in context C, S expresses the proposition that P. And then he gives explicit definitions of truth and falsity that conform to Ramsay's template. So these are TW and FW on the handout. You'll see it's just a version of Ramsay's view. You can think of TW and FW as extending the scope of Ramsay's accounts of truth and falsity to encompass all the possible utterances that could be made by uttering various type sentences in various contexts. Both Ramsay and Williamson describe the equivalences they suggest as definitions of truth and falsity. It's not altogether clear what they mean by that, and it's doubtful if any of these equivalences could serve as a definition in the strong sense of enabling someone who had not even an implicit grasp of the term being defined to understand it. For the definitions take as understood the notion of utterance as saying that P, or expressing the proposition that P, and it's plausible to hold that part of understanding what it is for an utterance to say that P is knowing that it's true if and only if P. If that's right, then the Ramsayan equivalences don't define truth and falsity in more basic terms. At best, they contribute to the definition of a package deal of interrelated concepts, somewhat as Newton's laws of motion contribute to the definition of force and inertial mass. Even if we disclaim all reductive or definitive ambitions, though, we can still ask if Ramsay's equivalences correctly describe the relationship between the notions of truth, falsity, and content. And it's that question which is going to be my focus this afternoon. In addressing it, one urgent task is to explicate the existential quantifier there exists P that appears in all four equivalences. How is this to be understood? Well, it's certainly not to be read as an objectual quantifier. Objects in the logical sense are things that might be signified by singular terms, but the variables bound by the exists P replace complete sentences, not terms. Neither, though, is it to be read as a substitutional quantifier. The substitution class C associated with a substitutional quantifier, sigma P, can certainly include complete sentences, but sigma P, U says that P and P means there's a sentence S in the substitution class which yields a truth when it's substituted for the variable P in U says that P and P. While this meaning is perfectly clear, yields a truth presupposes an antecedent understanding of what it is for an utterance or description to be true. So this formula provides no elucidation of U is true. It was one of Pryor's insights that these alternatives don't exhaust the available readings of their exist P. Natural languages, he remarked, contain a gamut of non-nominal quantifiers. In English we have, among others, however, somehow, wherever, and somewhere. No grammarian, Pryor comments, would count somehow as anything other than adverb, functioning in I hurt him somehow, exactly as the phrase by treading on his toe does in I hurt him by treading on his toe. We might also say, I hurt him in some way, and argue that by so speaking we're ontologically committed to the existence of ways, but once again there's no need to do it this way or to accept this suggestion. Well, I think that's just right, and when I speak of ways later, I'll mean no more than what could be expressed by an appropriate clause. As Pryor observed, non-nominal quantifiers like these enable us to interpret the formal devices there exists P and for all P. There exists P may be read as things are somehow, for all P as however things may be, and the variable P as things are thus. So there exists P such that U says that P and P can be understood to say U says that things are somehow, and they are thus, and that's an initially plausible elucidation that U is true. Similarly for falsehood. Pryor's gloss on there exists P then provides a nice English rendering of Ramsay's accounts of truth and falsity. It also allays any suspicion that might arise from the same bound variables appearing in the intentional context, following you says that, and an extensional one after the conjunction sign, for example. A way things might be may both be both the way someone says things are on a particular occasion of utterance and a way things actually are. Priori and sentential quantifiers also make possible an attractive way of stating logical laws. Under the influence of Quine, many philosophers imagine that such laws are inherently schematic. Thus, to accept excluded middle is to accept every instance of the schema, either A or not A. In this formulation, the logical words, either, or, and not, are mentioned, not used. And while there will be corresponding schema in other languages, the fact remains that on this approach, logical laws are tied to their linguistic expression. Prior sentential quantifiers provide an alternative approach. Using them, we can formulate excluded middle as follows. However things may be conceived to be, either they are thus or they're not thus, or in formal dress for all P, P or not P, where P now ranges not only over ways things might metaphysically be, but over any way in which things could be conceived to be. In these formulae, the connectives are U is not mentioned, which has advantages when it comes to modal status of the logical laws. It's a wholly contingent matter that the English word either, or indeed the formal formal symbol vel, signifies disjunction, so it's a merely contingent fact, if indeed it is a fact at all, that every instance of the schema, either A or not A, is true. If, though, suited middle is a logical law, then it will be true to say that it's logically necessary that, however things may be conceived to be, either they are thus or they're not thus. Okay, section 2, Strawson's account of truth. Prior's glosses don't fully explain there exists P and for all P. They give a rough indication of the intended sense of the quantifiers, but their logical properties are not thereby determined. There is, though, enough on the table, I think, to introduce a rival account of truth and falsity. This rival belongs to the same family as Ramsay's. It, too, characterises truth and falsity in terms which take as understood the notion of an utterance as saying that P, or that of beliefs being a belief that P, and it also uses priori and sentential quantifiers. The locus classicus of the account I have in mind is Peter Strawson's inaugural lecture at Oxford, Meaning and Truth. There, he proposed, as I quote, something uncontroversial and fairly general about truth, the following account of how that notion applies to the things he calls statements. Quote again, one who makes a statement or assertion makes a true statement if and only if things are as, in making that statement, he states them to be. Well, that does indeed seem to be another nice gloss on the notion of truth as it applies to statements, and it extends to a cognate account of truth for individual utterances. Somebody who produces a declarative utterance thereby speaks truly if and only if things are as he thereby says them to be, or thereby says they are. Strawson would have found descriptions of truth to utterances more than faintly barbarous. However, if we continue to permit ourselves the use of you is true and you says that P as abbreviations of in producing you its speaker speaks truly, and in producing you the speaker thereby expresses the proposition that P, we reach T and F on the handouts. And these T and F are, I think, recognisably versions of the Aristotelian ideas from which we started, and it's this version that I'm going to develop this afternoon. Well, how do T and F differ from Ramsay's T, R and F, R? Well, let's look back at T, R, the Ramsayan formula. According to T, R, the claim that U is true is equivalent to an existentially quantified conjunction whose first conjunct is U says that P. There's a natural sense, then, which I'll try to spell out soon, in which T, R counts U says something as part of the content of U is true. Similarly, if FR is correct, then part of the content of U is false is that U says something. By Ramsay's lights, then, a speaker who asserts U is true or U is false thereby asserts that U says something, i.e. that U has content. Strawson's formulae, by contrast, offer a subtly different account of this matter. An assertion that things are as U says they are, or if things are not as U says they are, is not naturally heard as asserting that there's a way U says things are. Rather, it's understood as presupposing as much, i.e. presupposing that U says something. A speaker who asserts things are as that utterance says they are takes it for granted and expects his audience to take it for granted that the utterance in question says something or has content. The usual linguistic tests confirm, indeed, that use having content is a presupposition of Strawson's accounts of its truth and falsity. Consider, if things are as John's statement says they are, then Mary's testimony is discredited. That implies there's a way John's statement says things are, and so does things are not as John's statement says they are. Moreover, it seems clear that the failure of this presupposition is, as people like to say, catastrophic. That's to say, if you lack content, then the ascription of Strawsonian truth or falsity to you will itself lack content. For according to Strawson, you as true means things are as you says they are. And if there's no way you says things are, then there's nothing left in the claim that things are as you says they are. Not all failures of presupposition are catastrophic in this sense, but this one, it seems to be, pretty clearly is. This difference between Strawson's account of truth and Ramsay's runs parallel to that between Strawson's theory of descriptions and Russell's. According to Russell, part of what's asserted when somebody asserts the present King of France is wise is that there's one and only one King of France. That's why Russell classifies the whole assertion as straightforwardly false. According to Strawson, by contrast, that there's a unique King of France is no part of what's asserted by the present King of France is wise. Rather, it's a presupposition of that assertion. In this particular example, indeed, Strawson held that the presupposition failure is catastrophic. Since there's no King of France, the present King of France is wise lacks a truth value altogether. The Strawsonian account of truth is not, so far as I can see, committed to Strawson theory of descriptions, but the analogy will prove to be suggestive as we develop the account of truth. So, a first step in that development is to locate more precisely the difference between Ramsay's and Strawson's accounts of truth. Let's say that A entails B when it's both the case, one, that B follows logically from A, and two, that the negation of A follows logically from the negation of B. Now, in any sensible logic of the sentential quantifiers, there exists a P such that U says that P does follow from there exists a P such that U says that P and P. Moreover, assuming that negation behaves classically, it's not the case that exists a P such that U says that P and P follows from it's not the case that exists a P such that U says that P. Given that assumption, then, we can say this. On Ramsay's theory, the truth of a declarative utterance entails that it has content. It's in this sense, no doubt a rather attenuated one, that the claim that U has content is part of what's said by U is true. On Strawson's account of truth, by contrast, there is no such entailment. For condition 2, for A to entail B, is that the negation of A follows logically from the negation of B, and in the present case this condition isn't met. For suppose that U has no content, from that supposition it doesn't follow that things are not as U says they are. To the contrary, the claim that things are not as U says they are presupposes that there is a way U says things are, just as much as does the corresponding affirmative claim. We have then a clear difference between Strawson's account and Ramsay's. The difference is rather subtle, but as I hope to show, it's important and really quite far-reaching. Okay, section 3, presuppositions and determinacy of content. On Strawson's theory, U is true presupposes that U has content. I've yet to give a positive account of what presupposes means. Many philosophers now follow Stolnicker in attaching a primary pragmatic sense to the term. On this conception, the claim that U is true presupposes that U has content amounts to the claim that a speaker who asserts U is true will ordinarily be understood as taking it for granted that U has content. Well, that's part of what I mean, but it's not the whole of it. The Stolnickerian presupposition may fail without such failure being catastrophic. In elaborating Strawson's account, we need to articulate the sense in which statement A presupposes B in such a way that B's not being true deprives A of truth of valuable content. To specify this relationship, we'll need to work in a logic which makes provision for statements which are neither true nor false, which are undefined, as people like to say. For definiteness, and to avoid unnecessary duplication of labour, I'll work in an extension of the system of simple partial logic that was set out by Stephen Blamey, in the second edition of the Handbook of Philosophical Logic. The beauty of Blamey's presentation, which owes a great deal to prior work by Dana Scott, is that the semantic clauses for the familiar connectives and the quantifiers are precisely the familiar classical clauses. The only changes in the classical semantics are these. First, it's not assumed that every atomic formula is either true or false, or that every n-place predicate is true or false of an arbitrary n-tuple of objects. an atom or predication may be undefined. Second, wherever the recursive semantic clauses fail to determine a complex formula as being either true or false, it too is classified as being undefined. So the semantic clause for conjunction on the handout says that A and B is true if A and B are both true, it's false if one of them is false, and it's otherwise undefined. The clause for the first order universal quantifier in Blaney's system assumes, as he puts it, that the relevant language has or can be extended so as to have a name A bar for every object A in the domain of quantification. He then gives the semantic clause on that assumption, as on the handout. Simple partial logic only has first order quantifiers, but we need to work an extended system, which I'll call simply partial logic, which also contains priori and sentential quantifiers. We can adapt Blaney's device to give semantic clauses for these quantifiers. Let's assume that our language has or can be extended so as to have a sentence W bar for each object W in the domain over which the priori and quantifiers range. That's the domain of ways things might be conceived to be. Then you can give the semantic clauses as given on the handout. I'll also follow Blaney in formalising partial logic as a sequence calculus with a double barrel condition for correctness. So the sequence X arrow Y is correct just in case A, some member of Y is true when all the members of X are true, and B, some member of X is false when all the members of Y are false. So a correct sequence transmits truth forwards along the arrow and also transmits falsehood backwards. The condition for multiple conclusion consequence is similarly double-barreled. So Y is a multiple conclusion consequence of X if and only if A, some member of Y is true in every interpretation in which all the members of X are true, and also some member of X is false in every interpretation in which all the members of Y are false. This definition has the very considerable advantage of ensuring that when A and B are consequences of one another, then they're logically equivalent, in the sense of having exactly the same status, that is, true, false, or undefined in every interpretation. As Blaney notes, the pure language of partial logic, that's without add-ons like our intentional logarithm to say, admits substitutivity of equivalence. When a formula is replaced by something equivalent, logic equivalent that is, then the resulting formula is equivalent to the original. This remains the case when a set of connectives is enlarged by adding priori and quantifiers. In addition to the familiar operators, Blaney introduces some that are specific to partial logic. For our purposes, the one that really matters is the two-place connective slash, which is what he calls transplication, which is defined as follows. So A slash B is true if A and B are both true, is false if A is true and B is false and is otherwise undefined. In A slash B, A is called the transplicator, and B is called the transplicand. I rather like these names, I must say. I'm quite aware they haven't exactly caught on, but they have a charm. So it's this connective, this transplication connective, which enables us to formalise the claims about presupposition that lie at the heart of Strawson's reply to Russell. So, you know, if KX is the present king of France and WX is Y's, then Strawson's analysis of the present king of Y's, the present king of France is Y's, can be formalised as on the bottom of page 3 of the handout. So what I presented there is what I should call the universal form of it, but it's equivalent to an existential form at the top of page 4 of the handout. Why is that? Well, in a circumstance where there's no unique present king of France, each of these formulae is going to be undefined, whereas in a circumstance where there's precisely one king, each formula is going to be true or false according to, as that individual is or isn't wise. So we can read A slash B as meaning B, presupposing that A, with the rider, that the failure of that presupposition is catastrophic in the sense of depriving the whole utterance of a truth value. For A slash B is undefined whenever A is not true. Okay, so the next move clearly is to use this slash connective to symbolise Strawson's account of truth. But before we can do that, we need to settle what exactly is presupposed by things are as you says they are. Ramsey's theory might lead one to expect that the presupposition is simply that you says something, but further reflection casts doubt on this. It's not enough that there should be some way things might be thought to be such that you says that things are that way. things are as you says they are means things are the way you says they are. And for this the presupposition for this statement is that there is such an entity as the way the way you says things are. Only if that requirement is met will you have a determinate content whose fulfilment can serve as the condition for you to be true. Now, quite how to spell out this requirement of determinacy is a very delicate matter. The intuitive idea is that use determinate in content if there's a way you says things are, and any other way you says things are amounts to the same as that one. This notion of amounting to the same is in acute need of philosophical analysis, but for present purposes, I think we can bracket this difficulty by introducing an intentional connective, the triple bar, understood so that P triple bar Q means to say that P is precisely to say that Q. Then, if U says that P is symbolised as say UP, we can formalise the claim that U is determinate in content as follows. There exists a P such that for all Q, U says that Q if and only if P triple bar Q. On Strawson's account, that U is determinate in content is a presupposition of both U's true and U's false. As remarked earlier, failure of this presupposition is going to be catastrophic for descriptions of both truth and falsehood. If there's no such thing as the way U says things are, then a speaker who utters things are as U says they are himself says nothing. We may then formalise the Strawsonian theory as the double sequence T and F, which are on page 4 of the handout. Again, you've got universal forms first and equivalent existential forms second. And the parallel between Strawson's theory of descriptions is by now, I think, I hope, completely evident. You can just see it on the page. Notice that the addition to partial logic of the sequence T and F can't generate an inconsistency by itself. For any such sequence is correct in any interpretation where no utterance U has determinate content. In such an interpretation, both antecedent and succedent of the sequence are going to be undefined. Okay, this formalisation confirms the earlier hypothesis that Ramsey's and Strawson's accounts give different verdicts in some cases. Here's a very simple example. Let U be an utterance of all mimsy were the borogroves. This utterance has no content. So the claim U says something is simply false. On Ramsey's account, then, the claim that U is true is straightforwardly false. According to T, though, the Strawson theory, the claim is undefined. And that, I think, is the result we want. The claim things are as U says they are is not naturally heard as false. If it were, it ought to be correct to say things are not as all mimsy were the borogroves says they are. But this doesn't seem to be a correct thing to say. Because there is no way all mimsy were the borogroves says things are, there's equally no content to the claim that things are not that way. So in a case where U says nothing, things are as U says they are also lacks truth value. Okay, section 4, the liar and the liar's revenge. What happens when we apply this account of truth to a paradox? Let little lambda be an utterance of this utterance is not true. It seems clear that if lambda says one thing, then that one thing, it says, is that lambda is not true. But then, the hypothesis that lambda says one thing generates a contradiction in a familiar way. Suppose lambda's true, in that case things must be as it says they are, so it's not true. Thus the supposition that lambda is true yields a contradiction, so it's not true. Given that lambda does say something, though, what it says is that lambda's not true, so things are as lambda says they are, whence it's true after all. The natural conclusion to draw from this, of course, is of course that lambda lacks determinate content. We can actually formalise this argument as a proof in partial logic if we assume that the not in this utterance is not true corresponds to the negation operator of partial logic whose semantics I've given at the bottom of page 4, i.e. if we assume that not A is true, if A is false, it's false if A is true and is otherwise undefined. The crucial fact is that this negation operator passes through a translocation in the sense that not A slash B is equivalent to A slash not B. So by applying this result to the existential form of Strawson's account of truth, we reach that the equivalence for not U at the top of page 5 and hence converting the transitively canned in the usual classical way to the universal form of the falsehood. So we prove that not to you is equivalent to you is false. Well, given that there's no one thing which Lambda says, should we infer that it says nothing or that it says more than one thing? Some writers have thought that the key to resolving the lie is to recognise that an utterance such as Lambda expresses more than one proposition. So Bradwardine argued for this in the 14th century, and Stephen Reed has recently tried to revive his solution. According to Bradwardine, every saying, as well as expressing its literal content, expresses its own truth. Thus, Lambda expresses both the proposition that it's not true, its literal content, and the distinct, indeed the contradictory content, that it is true. This offers an interesting way out of the paradox. In the spirit of the universal form of T, Bradwardine's requirement for an utterance to be true is that anything it says should be the case. So while we conclude that Lambda's not true, we can't conclude back from that it is true. For present purposes, though, I need not adjudicate between this theory, the Bradwardine one, and the one whereby Lambda expresses no proposition whatever. It'll be enough to establish there's no one thing which Lambda says. The reasoning that establishes that conclusion goes through with only minor modifications on Ramsey's theory. A follower of Ramsey can and should accept the premise of our derivation, namely, that if Lambda says one thing, that one thing is tantamount to the claim that Lambda's not true. Since the hypothesis up for refutation is precisely that the Strawsonian presuppositions of Lambda's truth are fulfilled, when deducing consequences from that hypothesis, we'd exclude the possibility, that of presupposition failure, in which Ramsey's account deviates from Strawson's. Many Ramseyans have indeed embraced the conclusion. Tim Williamson, for example, holds that Lambda says nothing at all. On his view, I quote, "The semantic paradox is transformed into sound arguments for what can and can't be said, for what can and can't say what, in what contexts." There is, though, a further twist to the paradox, and it's here that the two accounts of truth diverge significantly. Let's suppose, with Williamson, that Lambda says nothing. In the classical logic that he takes for granted, it follows that Lambda says nothing that's the case. By contraposing TR, though, we have that if Lambda says nothing that's the case, then it's not true. So it follows that Lambda's not true. But now we're again at a bind, the so-called liar's revenge. For by classically valid logical steps, Williamson can be led to make a statement, namely Lambda's not true, which by the likes of his own theory is without content. Well, Ramseyans are of course well aware of this difficulty. The most common response appeals to a change in context. When Lambda's unpacked using Ramsey's definition of truth, it amounts to, it's not the case that exists a P such that Lambda says that P and P. And it's a commonplace that the domain over which quantifier ranges may vary with the context of utterance. Accordingly, contradiction can be avoided so long as any way that Lambda's not true might say that things are, when that sentence forms part of a analysis of or commentary upon the paradoxical utterance, does not lie in the domain over which the quantifier implicit in the original utterance Lambda ranges. That's, of course, the approach that Charles Parsons took in his famous article on the liar paradox. Well, I've argued elsewhere that this strategy can't deal with all versions of the liar's revenge. It's consequently of some importance that the revenge problem doesn't even arise on Strawson's account of truth. The argument above shows that Lambda says no one thing. On Strawson's account, though, that Lambda says one thing is a presupposition of Lambda's not true just as much as it's a presupposition of Lambda is true. Since the presupposition fails, Lambda's not true lacks a truth value just as Lambda does. There's no sound deduction from Lambda says no one thing to Lambda's not true. Some people will protest that this just exposes an expressive inadequacy in the language of partial logic. Given that Lambda says nothing, they will still want to assert Lambda's not true, and they think there ought to be a so-called external negation operator which enables them to assert this. But is there? Empirical investigations into English and other languages suggest that such an operator is not to be found naturally. Moreover, a moral of the liar is that trying to introduce one artificially is going to generate contradictions. So the desire to assert that Lambda's not true should not, indeed cannot, be gratified. On this analysis, the liar reveals a limitation on what it's possible to express, but the limitation is not seriously restrictive. We can, indeed I think we do, live without external negation. If an objector insists there must be some way of saying the lamb is not true, we can go halfway to meet her, but there's nothing to stop us from denying the truth of lambda. On our analysis, lambda itself, its negation, and any statement that ascribes truth to it are one and all undefined. They all say nothing. We're within our rights, then, to deny any of these utterances, where denying a formula is a matter of rejecting it as having some status other than truth. We'll be ensnared again in the toils of paradox only if we postulate a negation operator, call it tilde, which asserting tilde A is tantamount to denying A in this sense. We ought to rest content with our denial and not try to factorise it into the assertion of any species of negation. Axiomatic theories of truth next. A depressing feature of current discussions of truth is that philosophical and logical approaches to the topic rarely intersect. Philosophers strive, as they always have done, to say in general terms what it is for the various bearers of truth to be true. But many logicians now disdain such elucidations in favour of axioms which regulate the behaviour of a truth predicate as it applies to the formula of a particular formalised language. A typical axiom of this kind says that the conjunctive formula is true if and only if both its conjuncts are true. Philosophers are unlikely to contest the truth of this, but they may reasonably object to its being taken to be axiomatic. Surely, they may protest, this so-called axiom ought to be grounded in a general elucidation of truth, something that can account for its applications to truth bearers other than well-formed formulae, together with particular principles about the meaning of conjunctions in the relevant system. In reply, though, logicians are apt to protest that the elucidations philosophers have come up with are simply too woolly to be useful. Thus, Leon Horsten, a leading proponent of the axiomatic approach, complains, I quote him, that all substantial philosophical theories of truth suffer from a lack of formal precision. Well, I'm going to defend the present account against this charge by showing how Horsten's preferred principles about truth and falsity are actually theorems of a theory whose axioms are versions of TNF, along with highly plausible axioms about what type sentences of various forms say. I say versions of TNF. We have to be careful about the categories to which truth and falsity apply. TNF describe the application of these notions to individual declarative utterances. But like most contemporary logicians, Horsten follows Tarski in applying them to type sentences. Not all type sentences are sensibly classified as true or false implicata. It makes no sense so to classify the English type sentence, I'm ill. However, after spelling out the appropriate restrictions, we can extend Strawson's account of truth and falsity so that it covers these Tarski-style applications of the notions. So, let's call a type sentence eternal if all utterances of it which express a proposition at all express the same proposition. And let an eternal sentence say that P if and only if any utterance of it expresses the proposition that P. Let's call an eternal type sentence contentful when it says something. A contentful sentence will express precisely one proposition. And finally, let's use tr and false, and tr and fls, to symbolise truth and falsity as they apply to eternal type sentences. Then we can lay down the equivalences tr and false on the handout with the Strawsonian versions of as they apply to these Tarskian type sentences. Note that since a contentful type sentence expresses precisely one proposition, we again have the corresponding existential forms. It's the bottom of page 5 of the handout. As with TNF, the theory that results from adding the sequence tr and false to partial logic is formally consistent. Any such sequence is vacuously correct in the interpretation where no eternal sentence of the relevant language says anything. So it's these equivalences, tr and false, which combine with plausible principles about which propositions eternal type sentences of various forms express to yield the equivalences about truth and falsity, which Horsten takes to be axiomatic. His preferred principles are those of a system called PKF, partial Kripke-Fefferman, which explicitly axiomatizes the fixed point account of truth whose models Kripke described in his 75 paper. So the background logic of PKF is simple partial logic, and its primitive connectives are negation, conjunction, disjunction, the first-order quantifiers. Its axioms include all of those of first-order Peano arithmetic, so that Peary can describe it to the syntax of its own formulae. It also contains a number of truth rules whose soundness amounts to the correctness of the sequence PKF 1 to 7 on the handout. No separate rules are given for falsehood, rather the falsehood of A is simply defined to be the truth of its negation. We've already noted that in Strawson's theory, the Falsterbo formula is demonstrably equivalent to the truth of its negation, so that's not a problem. Well, each of the sequence, 1 to 7, can be derived from true, TR, sorry, in tandem with appropriate additional sequence which specify what type sentences of various forms say. So on pages 6 and 7 of the handout, I have sketched derivations for numbers 2 and 7. 7 is particularly interesting, but I won't go through them. I'll just take them as read. If people have questions about how they work, then I can deal with them in discussion. The derivation of PKF7 is especially noteworthy, for many philosophers will reject the sequence correctness. So let capital lambda this time be the paradoxical type sentence. Capital lambda is not true, is not TR. Ramseyans will accept that lambda does not express a proposition. They'll infer from that, though, that it does not express a true proposition. That is, they'll infer not TR lambda. They won't, though, accept the truth of negation of lambda, so they're committed to rejecting PKF7. Horsten, then, another adherent of PKF, can be pressed to say why they think that this sequence is, after all, correct. I don't think it's going to be enough for them to point out that PKF is a consistent theory of truth, for there are many of those. What they really need is a philosophical elucidation of truth to set against the Ramseyan account with which PKF7 is incompatible. And Strawson's account, I claim, provides this. For these reasons, the philosopher's quest for such an elucidation can't in the end be avoided. As we've seen, moreover, that quest can be pursued without any compromise in logical rigour. A brief remark at the end about intentional paradox. As remarked earlier, no inconsistency arises from adding the sequence TNF to partial logic, and the same goes for the sequence TR and FLS. We shall, though, fall into inconsistency if we also add the wrong principles about which utterances or type sentences say what. Thus, if capital lambda is our paradoxical type sentence, we'll get a contradiction again if we add the disquotational semantic principle which says lambda says that lambda's not true. The paradoxes that directly and narrowly concern the notions of truth and falsity are, this suggests, dealt with quite easily. The real difficulties will lie in finding correct principles about intentional notions, such as saying that something is the case. Prior, I think, would have accepted that conclusion, for his writings on paradoxes focus on the intentional antinomies. Indeed, he focuses on cases where a thinker is unable to say or believe or even think what he imagines he's saying, believing or thinking because of unfavourable external factors, including what others have said or thought. I can't even survey this terrain today, but let me make one remark about it which bears on the present account of truth. The derivations of the truth rules of PKF that I've sketched, or rather mentioned, in the rely on principles about what type sentences of various forms say. Prior's discussion in On a Family of Paradoxes, though, may encourage despair that any systematic semantic theory of this kind is so much as possible. As we noted, someone who utters the liar sentence does not say what one first expects him to say, because he thereby says nothing at all. All the same, one is apt to hold, call this SW, that any English speaker who utters the sentence snow is white thereby says that snow is white. Prior, though, thought he could refute even that. Here's the argument he gave. Suppose Tarski utters snow is white immediately after Prior has said the following. If, immediately after this, Tarski says something that is the case, then what I'm now saying is not the case. Since snow is white, we reach a contradiction if we suppose both, one, that Tarski says that snow is white, and two, that Prior says that if Tarski immediately says something that is the case, then what Prior says is not the case. According to Prior, the only possible basis for holding that one of these utterances, rather than the other, succeeds in expressing a content is who got his say in first. That's a quote. Since Prior spoke first, he made it impossible for Tarski to say anything that's the case. So whatever Tarski did when he said the word snow is white, he couldn't have thereby said that snow is white, because that is the case. The most we can say about that sentence is that an English speaker who utters it says that snow is white, provided he says something at all. If it works, this argument could be applied to refute any principle to the effect that an utterance of a type sentence always says such and such. It would thereby scupper systematic semantic theorising in anything like the form we used to doing it. I don't think it does work, though. It seems to me that it accords quite unreasonable importance to temporal priority. A more sensible view takes account of whether the relevant sentences involve semantic predicates or propositional attitude verbs. As per SW, when Tarski utters the simple sentence, "Snow is white," he does succeed in saying that snow is white, and the fact that he expresses the truth shows it was Prior who failed to say anything by his previous utterance. On this view, whether Prior's utterance has a content is going to depend on whether Tarski subsequently utters the truth or a falsehood, so no judgment on whether Prior's attitude says something is possible before Tarski speaks. This consequence, though, doesn't seem to me to be implausible. Prior's words advert to Tarski's forthcoming utterance, and given what they mean, we should accept that whether they express a thought can depend on the truth value of that later utterance. To be sure, if the words immediately after this in Prior's scuppering formula were replaced by 10 years from today, we would have to wait 10 years to find out whether Prior had said anything. This consequence is certainly strange, but then again, the scuppering formula is itself a very strange thing to say. Most people, I think, will be prepared to swallow the consequence in order to preserve SW, and with it the possibility of a systematic semantic theory. Recalling his youthful flirtation with the so-called performative analysis of truth, a quite different account from that which I've been exploring today, Strawson recalled, and I quote from his Library of Learned Philosophers intellectual autobiography, he recalled fatuously announcing to George Paul, that was his colleague at UNIV, that I had a new theory of truth, to which Paul sensibly and characteristically replied, "Come on now, which of the old ones is it?" Well, there's been no pretense of novelty today. All the same, it can be worth, I think, blowing the dust off one of the old theories, tracing its exact relationship to its rivals, and reassessing it in the light of more recent philosophy. That's what this paper has tried to do.